From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, a conversation with RT's Peter Laveau, who's the host of RT's program, Crosstalk, about some of the things going on in the world, in particular, the shooting in Las Vegas, the recent Catalonia referendum, and the attack that's underway from the U.S. government on RT and Sputnik. Peter, welcome back. It's a pleasure to have you, as always.
It's always good to be on your program, Don.
So we have a lot to talk about. I don't know. I guess we could start with Las Vegas, maybe talk about Catalonia, lots of things going on all over the world. One thing I saw go by me on Facebook that was interesting was nuclear weapons don't kill people. People kill people, signed Kim Jong-un.
Well, geez, I guess I'll have to agree with him on that. I mean, that for me is when I looked at, you know, I live very far away. I live in a culture where there is no gun culture. I mean, if it is, it's part of a military tradition. People don't own guns. They don't talk about guns. Basically, when they talk about guns, it's because, did you see what happened in America?
Right.
and people are very wary of that. But, you know, I think it goes beyond the gun debate. And I think that's really what the discussion has to be. We both know, you know, how to deal with the Second Amendment. In my lifetime, I don't think I've ever met anyone that changed their position. Maybe it happens sometimes. But it's the culture and it's the polarization of culture that's going on in the United States that I think is part of the problem here. It doesn't excuse that shooter and this amazingly horrific. It's breathtaking looking at the pictures.
Yeah.
But when I watch the cable networks, there's no one wants to go into that area. What's wrong with the country? It's always what's wrong with people with guns. And I don't think that's enough.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you have a condition on the one hand with some countries have, you know, zero guns, and so there are no, you know, shootings, for example, but and others where there are guns all over the place and also no shootings or very low. And here in the United States, you know, when they talk about the Wild West, which is almost part of the global lexicon as a concept, you know, they're talking about the Western United States in the, 19th century, and that was gun culture, you know, par excellence. You had people that basically imposed their will, created their villages, towns, cities with, you know, at gunpoint, literally. And it's a country that's carved its position out in the world. It's been at war most of its 200 and some odd years of existence. So, you know, there has to be some kind of correlation between these public policies, you know, both domestically and globally, and the behavior of the people here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a great deal of the Wild Wild West is really mythology, okay? I think if you were to do a cross-section of the people that actually went west, a lot of them were not the great pioneers we'd like to think they were. A lot of them were running away from problems. Various things that were probably illegal or immoral, and they reinvented themselves. There's nothing wrong with that, but let's not mythologize something. The thing is it, for me, when I was growing up, as a child, I grew up in Colorado, and I was surrounded by guns and by really good, solid people. The people understood guns and what they were for. It was for target practice. It was for hunting. It was for marksmanship. It wasn't the kind of the gung-ho thing about I'm packing heat. And that's what it gets down to is I think people feel so powerless and so marginalized.
Yeah.
I'll say the word that just really came to my mind for is this awful tradition. Sorry. Because I think it is awful.
Yeah, I
think we need to be able to show our great attributes through other means and not have something, a lethal weapon in our pocket. And I'm not saying I'm against the Second Amendment. I think, you know, I respect the foundation, the idea of it. Okay, but its expression today in urban environments. Anyway, you know, we go back to the founders. I mean, that was, you know, you had the entire frontier. There was a reason for guns. But you know, buying a semi-automatic weapon and to be able to carry 50 shots in it. I mean, what are you worried about? Okay, I mean, what's going to face you? So I think it's this, people feel impotent. And I think the political system has made people that way. I think I've said on your program before, why are these zombie films so popular in Hollywood, and why do the people watch it? Because they feel like zombies.
Right.
Look at the political debate. It's, you know, it's nitpicking, tit for tat. It's all one-liners. You know, it's Twitterizing the political discourse more. We have much more deep problems than what you can put in 140 characters.
Yeah. You know, in 1984, Orwell wrote about the plans of the party, basically, to reduce the language to a point where it would be impossible to commit thought crime because the words wouldn't exist for it, so the concepts couldn't be formulated. And it's almost like the political discourse here, you know, is following that kind of a formula, because it's exactly right. They talk, you know, there are code words that are used, and there are, you know, cliches that are used, and they scream at each other, and no one ever addresses fundamental problems, which are at the source, I'm sure, of some of the anger in the country, which is the complete insecurity that people have, the sense of powerlessness that they have to deal with it, and the non-responsiveness of the institutions here.
Absolutely. I think it was last week, a program that we did, we were looking at political change, what's going on, and reaction to like the rise of Antifa, if it's even a myth. I mean, I couldn't believe that the left-wing media was saying it doesn't even exist. It's astounding to me. Right. But, you know, what's really interesting is what you were just saying is that, you know, the level of the, what is it, the chicken or the egg here? Because are the people that are in this media industry right now, I mean, their intelligence IQ strikes me as being extremely low. They're very inarticulate. They don't delve into these issues. They don't understand the context. But it's always the dog whistle, which, you know, Chris Cuomo was saying, Trump talks as if he's a dog whistle. Mm. My reaction to that is, no. Corporate media is the dog whistle.
Yeah.
They're the ones that's always blowing the whistle, telling us how to feel, how to react. And I find that really, it's really a world turned upside down. It's Orwellian. You brought up Orwell. This is this kind of dog whistle thing. So when we see something like in Las Vegas, well, we have to do something about guns. We have to do this. And my attitude is that, you know, and watching those horrific things, it really hurt. It really hurt watching that. Why we have a culture that is so very angry, so divided, and where people don't find that they have ways to work out their problems or even recognize what their problem is, instead of just, you know, grabbing a gun and just, you know, expressing something in such a negative, truly diabolical way.
You know, you have this toxic environment, you know, culturally, socially, historically, because, you know, you mentioned, you know, people needed guns in the West, for example, but the purpose of those guns was for the people that were entering the West to steal the land away from the people that lived there by killing them.
Absolutely.
So, you know, that must also somehow express in the culture at some point. But also, you have not just that, like this, you know, again, the history, the sociology, the sociopathology of this. There's also this whole massive infusion of tranquilizers, chemicals, legal and illegal, when you have a society that institutionally decides it is not going to respond to the conditions that create anxiety or mental illness in people, in other words, poverty, insecurity, those things, then what it does is it treats the symptoms, you know, saying, okay, well, look, these things would normally make people rebel. They're all upset that, you know, they don't understand it because they haven't studied, like, that this is what's causing you to feel this way. So they go to the doctor, we drug them. And then you see when these drugs are advertised, you know, one of the things that's most notable in all of them, from quitting smoking to various tranquilizers, is it may induce suicidal ideation. Now, these killings are suicide by mass murder. Almost every one of them ends up dead.
You know, it's interesting that you mention pharmaceuticals, because a few years ago at RT, I had a producer, and she had studied medicine for a while, and I guess I had a cold or something. I don't know what it was, but I wasn't feeling very well. And I said, I need to go I was going to say apteca, which means pharmacy.
Yeah.
And she said, you Americans, all you do is your whole pharmaceutical industry is to mask problems, not to address them. You make the pain go away, but the problem is still there.
Right.
And I thought that was really very interesting observation.
Yeah.
Because this is exactly what happens to us all the time. When you do, you know, why do people feel that they need guns? And I would say because people feel so powerless over their destiny.
Yep.
That is a token. It's a physical token of their empowerment. And I think that's a very sad comment on any society when you feel empowered because you can carry lethal force.
Yep.
That shows a level of society that's very anemic right now. And I think it's only going to get worse. And what happens is that doesn't bring in the political equation. It's not the Trumpers and CNN. This addresses, affects all people.
Right.
In so many ways. And this artificial injection of politics is a cover. It's a mask. It's not dealing with the real problems.
Right. And it's not even real politics, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, at a fundamental level, it is, because you have one small group of people who are exercising their politics over everyone. But that's which is being presented, and the discussion that happens among one sector of the, you know, people representing half the population, this other sector representing the other half, supposedly only symbolically, because none of them ever actually pose a solution in public to the problems of the people in the country, which would be some serious fundamental change to the system. You never hear anybody talking about that on television, believe me.
Absolutely. and that's why I feel so free in what I do, because, you know, I get to address these issues with my guests, because no one wants to talk about the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and it's called systemic crisis. And this is one of the things that's really troublesome and really quite sad, is because I think you probably saw I put on Facebook a week or so ago, I said democratic elections don't solve problems anymore. And this system that we have now is so exhausted, because, my favorite mantra, and I think the most interesting thing of the 2016 election was not the election of Donald Trump, not at all. Okay, the mainstream media made him, and now they're paying for it. Okay, right. But what happened was that Bernie Sanders was cheated. This is the real story of 2016.
Yep.
Because here was someone, I don't agree with him on everything,
right,
but here was someone that articulated an alternative to the systemic problems of the United States. And I'm in full admiration. I follow everything he says. I don't, like I said, a lot of things I don't agree with him on. But here was a man that actually, and you know, I'm a cultural conservative.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And here was a guy that actually said something coherently of the whole bunch. And I think that kind of discussion really needs to be engaged. You know how he was just dismissed, left and right, center, everything.
Yep.
But you know what? That's why he was popular and still is popular. And I think Bernie Sanders, and someone like Bernie Sanders, is someone that people of many different shades of political belief can listen to, and that's what I do. And it's great to disagree with someone coherently, with a real argument, with a real debate.
Yeah, for sure. You know, there's some interesting the phenomenology in last year's election and he's describing one part of it. I would say probably Bernie Sanders was opposed by the whatever the powers that be. In the United States, the election was stolen from him, with the full effort of a lot of folks on the inside, over his economic message, over his, the potential of the things he was raising in terms of the unfairness of the economy and the political system. His foreign policy was not really dissonant with the foreign policy establishment in this country. On the other hand, Trump's was very much, and his economic policy was maybe a little dissonant, but more, I think, the opposition from the parties, that the powers that be, to him came from the foreign policy changes that he was talking about.
But Bernie has mended his ways since then. He's come out more robustly over the last couple of weeks and nuancing his foreign policy. Yeah, I think it's really sad that he did it after the election.
Yeah, yeah.
Better late than never.
Yeah.
And I think that, but what I think he's doing is creating a space, a political space.
Yeah, that's where I was
gonna go. Not just for himself, but for that kind of message. I mean, look, you know, Trump is asking, and Congress amended it even higher, an increase of defense spending over what was originally asked for that could wipe out almost all student debt in the United States.
Right. No, I understand all this.
You know, I'm a cultural conservative, but if someone said to me, you know, why don't we slow down the, I mean, the United States has the most powerful military, bar none. I mean, really.
Right.
Okay. But maybe we should cut back on that, and maybe we just pay off this debt crisis of young people.
Right.
I mean, that's a no-brainer, Don. That's a no-brainer.
No kidding. I mean, look. Well, all right. Let me go back, because the reason I refer to it as phenomenology instead of politics is looking at not just what Trump or Sanders or anyone intends to do, but rather how, you know, their position, their, you know, being lifted in the first place was a result of things that are happening, you know, in the society, dynamics and, you know, in within the society. And there was resonance for Sanders' economic message and for Trump's foreign policy message and resistance from the power structure to those very things in each case. For Trump, it's Russiagate, that's how they attack him. For Sanders, he's a socialist and he's going to spend us into oblivion over Medicare for all and blah, blah, blah. And so what that tells you, though, is that within the population, there's support for both those positions. For on the one hand, because I don't think Sanders was getting lift because of his foreign policy that was, you know, really indistinguishable from the neocons, Clinton and everybody else. And I don't think Trump was getting support except from a small part of the population over the most reactionary things that he said. In each case, it was, first of all, the economic insecurity issue. That was a commonality between both of them, and that the economy is rigged. They were both saying that, and that the political system was rigged. They were both saying that. But with Trump, he was emphasizing foreign policy. I saw the standing ovations over no more regime change, let's make friends with Russia and all that at the RNC. And with Sanders, they were calling him a socialist, and every time they did, he went up in the polls. So I think it indicates in the population great potentiality that requires some thoughtful construction of unity around both of those tendencies.
Yeah, but the thing is, we can go back to the massacre in Las Vegas, and what you were just saying is that I think you've really hit the major word here, and rigged. And I think across the board, people think everything is rigged.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that anger, that the perception, and probably it is real, as you explained. But I think this again makes people look inward, turn inward, and look to protect themselves. They're out to get me, and you know what? They are being. That's a legitimate feeling right now.
Yep.
You know, when I look at like the Trump's tax cut, I mean, the more I look at it, I don't see it really as a boon for the heartland. I just don't. Okay. Maybe I can be convinced otherwise.
Right.
But, you know, when you go on to CNN, you know, it's a disaster. It's only for the rich. And then when you go to Fox News, this is for the middle class. And I don't believe either one of them.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Because if they got Afghanistan wrong, they get Syria wrong, they get Ukraine wrong, they get Russia wrong, they get North Korea wrong. Why should I assume they're going to get taxes right?
They're not going to get anything right. I mean, you know, you mentioned before the basically like the low output of the people that are delivering this stuff. The other part of it is that a lot of them are just reading off a teleprompter. They don't even have enough skill to generate the stuff they're mouthing themselves, as weak as the stuff they're mouthing is.
Well, maybe our listeners will be a little bit surprised, but I'll give you a little inside trade secret on my part. I can read about five lines in a row. Outside of that, I can't read. I can't. Everybody at RT just has a good laugh at it. Said, don't make them read anything, okay? Because I'm dyslexic. I'm just computer ad lib, okay? I mean, I get through the introduction, which is like four lines, as you know. Yeah. I do the guess, and then I just go right into the discussion because I don't want to read anything because I'm not good at it, okay? And it's not expressing myself, okay? Anyone that can do it for 2 or 3 minutes at a time, I think they're amazing.
Well, yeah, it's great. And hopefully they relate to what they're reading somehow, you know, either as the author of it or, you know, this is somebody that I hired and or partner with because we agree on these things. And, you know, they write a little better than I do and I read a little better than they do, rather than, hi, the boss is making me read this stuff, and I'm going to read it. And unfortunately, I'm reading it badly, but that's okay because they write it badly, which is kind of what we get.
Well, that's one of the reasons why they like me. They know that I'm just, you know, just, and then they say Q, and that's, I just go on, okay? But, you know, that's the way it should be, because today we did a program on Catalonia, for me, it's a very interesting story because it's so much more complex than what the mainstream is expressing. The horrific images of people being beaten up, that's awful, and it should be absolutely condemned. Going to vote is an act of protest. Wow, we've really made progress in this 21st century. But the story there is a lot more complex, and I do a sampling, obviously, because of what I do for a living. I have to look at what everybody else is doing. And I was just, again, just so disappointed. You know, most of these people don't have a clue of what they're talking about. Oh, they go to the dog whistle things. Francisco Franco is back.
Yeah, right.
Okay, well, I know the history of the Spanish Civil War very well. Anyone that says that is a fool.
Yep. You know, how many people that discuss referenda, for example, mention in the same breath the referendum that took place in Crimea, the recent referenda that took place, the pair, in Venezuela? When they're talking about nation states, you know, on the one hand, you've got the history of European nation states, some of which were cobbled together very late in the game, like Germany and Italy in the, you know, late 19th century, and with changing borders and, you know, ethnic groupings sort of inside and outside state boundaries and all of that. And then comparing that to the nation states that exist in the former colonies, where different nationalities were deliberately placed inside the state boundary lines in order to have an internal tension, divide and, you know, rule kind of thing.
That's the Middle East. Yeah. That's the whole Middle East.
Africa also, you know, parts of Asia were like that as well, although that shook out differently. And, you know, that, and in Latin America, they did that too, although it was a little more, malleable here. But nobody even brings that stuff up when they're talking on CNN, Fox, wherever.
Yeah, the thing is that what I stressed in my program is that I truly believe in self-determination. But what are its limits? What about legitimacy? What about law? These are very complicated things. And because of the state of the media, everything is very simplistic.
Right.
And it's one-dimensional. Essentially, how are we going to benefit from this? Or how is this against the Russians? Or, you know, the Russians must be behind this. You know, it's mind-boggling. I mean, how much waste of airtime that I have to watch about people that don't know what they're talking about. You know, what's going on in Catalonia is so important about what the European Union experiment is all about. And how the European Union is responding to it needs to be looked at. I didn't see any of that in the airwaves. All I saw was emotion, emotion, emotion. And of course there's emotion, and the use of force against voters is absolutely wrong. But what if, as John Loughlin, as you'll see when the program airs, I mean, John Loughlin and I both agreed this looks eerily like the Maidan.
Right.
I mean, or who's pulling the strings here?
Exactly.
And to who, what benefit? I mean, Catalonia is one of the most liberal, is probably the most liberal part of Spain. It is the most wealthy part of Spain.
Right.
They want to become a member of the European Union. They don't want to get out of it. They want to join it. There are members of their leadership that are for secession that want to join NATO. And you know what? NATO wants them to join, too.
Right.
I suggest that our listeners go to the Atlantic Council website, and they have a whole white paper on how Catalonia could be a very interesting member to NATO. I mean, these are all these different layers that are there to be, just to be learned about. You don't have to have much effort. You have Mr. Google and type it in.
Right. And you know, when you go to the question of self-determination, you know, you start with a definition of terms. And let's start with self. Who exactly is the self that's doing the determining? When you don't have democratic societies, I mean, and I'm talking about essentially democratic societies, not societies that have the forms of voting, but where power and information, access to these things, you know, are evenly distributed, equally, you know, equitably distributed, so that everyone is making an informed decision when they're looking to make some major, you know, change in their condition and consider their self-interest. They know what their self-interest is. They've been educated to understand how the world works. They have accurate information about it, and they can go to the polls without getting their head creased in by a club. Well, if you don't have those conditions, is it really self-determination of the, you know, Catalonian people to have a vote? See, in you had in Crimea exactly that condition. The people there, like 90-some-odd percent of them that turned out, the question was, do we go with Russia or stay with Ukraine, said Russia. And you look at them, why? They're Russians. It made sense.
Well, the thing is, you're absolutely right, because in the case of Crimea, they knew what self-determination meant. It meant not being with a crypto-fascist regime in Kiev.
Right.
That's but in the case of Catalonia, it's infinitely more complex.
That's right.
You're absolutely right. The phrasing of the secessionist ballot move can be open. It's open to so many different interpretations. And this is why I'm a little skeptical. Number one, the Spanish government was absolutely grotesquely stupid to stop it the way they did.
Yeah, that was dumb.
Because before, if you look at the polls, it wasn't a slam dunk. It was not a slam dunk to vote for secession.
That's right.
And with this brutal activity on the state of the on the part of the state authorities, they galvanized people.
Right.
I mean, yes, in that moment, that heated moment of emotion, a lot of people say, "I won't say it on your program, but you know, we're going to do this, okay?" Because they're beating up grandmothers on the street.
Right.
They're throwing people downstairs. I saw all of this.
Yep.
And you know, and but find out what the sentiment is. Maybe it was a flawed referendum, but let's take a look at it, okay? And they've lost that.
Yeah.
And now it's turning into a cascade effect on both sides that is diminishing what self-determination means probably for a lot of people that probably even voted.
Yep. Well, we've got like a minute and a half left. I just want to ask you real quick about the situation here in the United States, essentially piling on to, in particular, Russian media, but that really is a bellwether of what's coming for everything that's dissonant with the corporate media here. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm a bit pessimistic, to be honest with you. I think that the drive to push RT and Sputnik out of the U.S. will continue. There's no pushback, almost no pushback in the United States among journalists and media watchers. Turning RT and Sputnik into agents, foreign agents, the registering as a foreign agent, is a trap. And it's never been applied to media companies. This is a precedent that nobody in the Western media talks about. And that's a chilling effect for, still another chilling effect about journalism in the United States and the West. If the pressure that's being applied against RT and Sputnik will probably rear its ugly head in the UK, because RT is very popular there. They want their monopoly back, Don. They want their monopoly back. So they can continue peddling the messages that you and I have talked about in this program here. This is a very black, dark time for journalism. And before this happened, it wasn't in good shape at all. And now it's going to continue down the path of deteriorating, where you just get this monospeak and this pretend left-right, you know, conservative, progressive. It's all nicely melded so people can understand it as if it was something specific. It's all one message. And you can quibble about the 1% or 2% on the margins. That's not our reality. Our reality is very, very different. Look what's happened in Las Vegas. Look at the other massive massacres in the United States. There's something very, very wrong going on.
That's right.
And you know what? People aren't talking about it.
Peter, thank you very much. Pleasure.
My pleasure.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.